Unlike the previous speakers who had a Mishnah Sdura, well-organized talks, I'm going to ramble because the subject is so vast and so diverse and encompasses so many different areas of thought and so many challenges that it's difficult to have a sort of a truly organized talk, certainly in the time allotted. What I'd like to say at the outset is that halakha always met the challenges of modernity at all periods of time. Whether it's 2,000 years ago, whether it's 1,500 years ago, 1,000 years ago, 500 years ago, each time the halakha faced the challenges of the contemporary situation and sought to find solutions which were livable with. I know you're not meant to end with a preposition. The examples are well known probably to all of you, but nonetheless it's worth listing them briefly. We're now in Shnat HaShmita, the sabbatical year, and according to the classical biblical law, during the sabbatical year all debts were cancelled, Shmitat Safin. When Hillel, around the year zero of the Common Era, saw that people were no longer lending money to poor people because it would be a dead loss for them since they weren't permitted to take interest, and at the end of a couple of years probably the debt would be cancelled completely, he developed a technique, a halachic technique called the Puzvul, which circumvented the laws of Shmitat Safin. Apparently there was some new economic situation, socio-economic situation, which had arisen. Hillel saw the grave threat to the poor and the impoverished, and he found a solution which was accepted by one and all. In a much later period of time, probably in the 14th century, when a similar situation seems to have arisen, and people were no longer giving loans to poor people because until that time they were not permitted to take interest on those loans, and why should you give money if you're not going to get anything out of it? So rabbis, maram, whoever that is, introduced a new technique called the heter iska, which we all use, whether we're aware of the fact or not, which permitted people to take interest on their loans. In Israel, every single person that has a bank account is receiving interest, is giving interest, and they all do so halachically on the basis of this heter iska, which is a little piece of paper which was probably pinned up in some inside room which nobody ever sees, in the manager's office, in the bank manager's office. So here's two very obvious examples of a challenge which was a threat to the society of that time, whether it was in the year zero or whether it was the year 1500. And the leading authorities, when they saw that this was a serious threat, and when the situation became such that it worked counter to the intention of the biblical law or the rabbinic law, then they had to find a solution, and they found a solution, which was within the parameters of classical normative halakha. Because it was very clear that the laws of the cancellation of debts, Shmitat Ksafim, was to encourage people to help poor people. And the reason you were not permitted to take usury, interest, was again because the person that takes a loan finds it very difficult to pay it back, and as he delays the repayment, the interest grows, and he falls into a rut which he can't get out of. And that's why the biblical laws were formulated the way they were. But when these laws themselves worked against the intention of the Torah, and people were getting impoverished because they couldn't receive loans, then the rabbis felt that there was a need to use some sort of halakhic technique to circumvent these laws. In the present day, I spoke about it yesterday, we have a similar situation where the law of Shemitah, biblically, or maybe nowadays it's rabbinically, forbids any sort of agricultural activity for a whole 7 years in Eretz Yisrael, something which in the present situation is economically unacceptable. It would bring about an economic disaster in Israel from many points of view, as we discussed yesterday. And therefore the rabbis, beginning in the 18th century and continuing into the 19th and the 20th century, found again a solution which would circumvent this particular law, a law which is originally of biblical authority and nowadays perhaps of rabbinic authority, and they worked out the so-called heter mechira, the way in which we can get out of this particular constraint upon our agricultural activities in Eretz Yisrael, the heter mechira. The examples are legion, and throughout the history of the halakha, in every generation where there have been these types of problems that have caused a threat to the Jewish community, whether they're to individuals or whether they're to the general community, the rabbis struggled, they sought solutions, and for the main part they found solutions. That's not to say that every single halakhic challenge can find its solution. But, as I always mention, the halakha is tremendously rich and tremendously diverse. Our heritage is one of a vast treasury of literature which one can dip into, search out, and to use as a means for finding the sort of solutions that are necessary in each day and age. So halakha has always faced the challenges of modernity. Each generation had its own modernity, and they stood up to those challenges, they accepted them, and they didn't cast a blind eye to them. They were fully aware of them, they faced those challenges. Sometimes there were solutions that were accepted by some and not by all. There may have been controversies over the subject, but ultimately they did find solutions with which the society could live. So halakha has always been dynamic, it's always been evolutionary, at times even revolutionary. When you think of the Brosbol or the Heter Iska or the Heter Mechira, these are truly revolutionary halakhic moves. And it's always tried to keep up to date. It's an accepted fact that law normally lags behind the sociological developments. So there's sometimes a generation lag. But nonetheless, eventually we catch up and we search out solutions and we, for the most part, can find them, if we seek to do so. So change, evolution, modulation of halakha is something which is inbuilt into the halakhic structure. And even the klalei hapsak, the rules which we use to determine halachic determinations are built in such a way that they more or less demand change. Halacha kebatrai, we rule according to the later authority rather than the earlier authority. That means to say that to a certain extent we're not necessarily bound by the earlier authorities. There are rules and regulations which earlier authorities are binding and which are less binding, but the mere fact that there exists a Talmudic and Gaonic ruling of halacha kebatrai, that the halacha goes according to the later opinion, and there's a justification for that, means that those who formulated the klalei hapsak were aware of the fact that there was going to be a difference between the earlier and the later opinion, and they gave us an indication that we should move with the time in our halachic determinations. And the truth is that this was always the case. This was always the case, perhaps, up to the beginning of the 19th century. In the beginning of the 19th century, there was a towering halachic authority who lived in Pressburg, who you've all heard of, with Moshe Sofer, who lived in Pressburg, the Chatam Sofer, and he was challenged by a new phenomenon, for him a new phenomenon, and that was the development of the Reform movement, the Neolog movement. Now, the Neolog movement, when they started to try to reformulate Jewish law, Jewish customs, they started usually with customs, because those are the things which are least text-bound. Nobody really knows why we do things, and they often don't have literary sources, and therefore they seem to be more flexible. Halachically, they're more flexible. We can deal with them more easily. So that's what they started off with. And then they moved into the area of halacha proper, and even reinterpreted biblical verses in a new fashion. And this constituted a great challenge and a great danger, lechomat ha-halacha, to the wall, to the bastions of halacha. And the Chatam Sofer saw this as a great danger to the Orthodox community, and they were called ha-mechadshim, the innovators. And they were innovating Jewish law. And he fought against these innovators in every possible way, and marshaled the opinion of his colleagues of the same ideological bent, and published broadsides, and published pamphlets signed by many rabbis, and published tshuvot, his sponsor, in which he ruled all sorts of things as being asur min haTorah, things that are forbidden by biblical law. For example, moving the bima from the center of the synagogue to one side was asur min haTorah. For a rabbi to wear clerical garments was asur min haTorah. For a synagogue to use vernacular within the synagogue was asur min haTorah. How it's asur min haTorah, that's another question. But it's asur min haTorah. Why was it asur min haTorah? Because chadash asur min haTorah. Because any sort of innovation is forbidden by biblical law. Now, Chadash Asur Min HaTorah, as you probably know, the phrase itself comes from a totally different halakhic field. It deals with the new crops, the new wheat and so on, so that comes from the new year, which cannot be eaten up to a certain time. That is Chadash. But he used this phrase as a slogan against the reform, the newly nascent reform movement. And he said, Chadash Asur Min haTorah, all these innovations that are taking place in the synagogue, and all the other innovations that they were making, the new Sidurim, for example, these were all Asur Min haTorah. He had a tremendous influence, and the truth is that the Reform movement gained strength, and as the Reform movement, and then afterwards the Neologim and the Conservative movement, etc., gained strength, so the opposition to them had to gain strength, and had to be bolstered by additional bastions, by strengthening the bastions of the law. And this meant basically that everything had to be petrified and stultified. There could be no more innovation. You have to, the year 1800 is when everything gets, as it were, ultimately formulated. Let me give you an example of the type of of the type of ultra-traditionalism that developed out of this movement, this ideology. Very recently there were some volumes published, wonderful volumes by a scholar in Eretz Yisrael, on the customs of the people of the forgotten. It'll come back to me in a moment. I'm bad at names. In Eastern Europe, and he tells the following story. From the late 19th century, he states that in the synagogues in Poland, in the men's synagogues in Poland, there were no fireplaces, there were no heating appliances. Presumably because most of the synagogues were wooden synagogues and it would have been dangerous. And he says that in the winter time, they couldn't get a minyan usually because it was too cold. The rabbi used to come and they used to pay a few people as minyan men, and he says that at times you could see his beard had turned into an icicle. And so somebody suggested that they introduce a fireplace in the synagogue. Mattersdorf was the town. Minage Mattersdorf and the five communities around there. And the rabbi said, no, Chadash Asur Min HaTorah. We never had fireplaces in our synagogues. We will not have fireplaces. Even though they couldn't keep a minyan, and even the people froze. An additional example he gave is that the seats were never padded. They were very hard. And the older people, you know, not always so comfortable to sit on a hard bench. So somebody, a person who was wealthy, suggested that they pad the seats of the benches. And the rabbis came up with a halachic determination of Psak Halacha. No, Chadash Asur Min HaTorah. We may not pad the seats because we never had padded seats for 200 years, for 300 years. The son of the Chofetz Chaim, in his memoirs, relates that the Chofetz Chaim never allowed ha'elektrish in his synagogue. Not on Shabbat. Weekdays. Because elektrish was chadash, was something new. Traditionally, they've never had elektrish in the synagogues. The chadash asur min haTorah. So I could give you dozens of examples of this outer traditionalism, which sort of stultified and petrified halakha, and within certain circles of Jewish society in Eastern Europe, it became the major slogan, and it continued through the Mishneh Berurah into the Chazon Ish, that innovation was absolutely forbidden. Even though the truth is that the Chazon Ish, even though he takes this line, he himself made many, many halakhic innovations. The Chatam Sofer had a large following, and what he said was accepted, Maram Shik, others, and it became, as it were, the standard form of halachic thinking. There's a story told, and it purports to be a true story, which may be apocryphal, may not be, that once a certain great Polish rabbi, who wrote very important halachic works, was approached by the local neolog rabbi, in other words, I guess reform, and he said, let's try to come to some sort of modus vivendi. After all, we're all Jews, and we all want Achdut Yisrael, we want the unity of Israel. Let's try to come to some sort of agreement between us. Surely, I'll make a certain, we'll discuss, we'll begin discussions, I'll make some sort of compromise, you make some sort of compromise, we'll begin a process of getting together, a dialogue. So the rabbi said, well, let me think about it for a few days, and let me think of an area in which I can think of possibly finding a compromise which would be acceptable to me from my halachic standpoint and which would satisfy you as a first stage in this process of hitkarvut, of getting together. At the end of a few days they met together, this neolog rav and this great Polish rabbi, and the reform rabbi asked him, well, do you have a suggestion? And he said, look, I've tried very hard, and unfortunately I didn't find an area in which I'm willing to compromise. So he said, well, what have you thought about in the first place? Which area did you think it would be possible to compromise? So he said, it's as follows. Works out, this is what I was thinking about. According to the halakha, there are certain rules of how you pair your nails. What days you can do it, what hours you can do it, the order of the pairing of the nails, and how you cut your nails. And when you cut your nails, you know, you mustn't throw them away, because if a woman who's pregnant steps across them, chas v'chalila, she may have a premature birth or something like that. So you have to be very careful, and you have to burn the pairing of the nails. And therefore, when you pair your nails, you have to collect the pairings, and you have to put little slivers of wood with them so that they should burn well, and then you burn them. Now, our custom is that the wood that you add to the nail pairings, we cut off with our sharp little knife from the table that we eat at. And our tables have normally four legs. And I thought that perhaps we could make an innovation which you would accept. That we would use a three-legged table that we could use for the pairing of the wood to add to the nails, which we could afterwards burn. And I thought about it a great deal for the past few days, and I said, no. Zechadash was the asur bilatura. Whether this is apocryphal, although it appears in a number of different sources, and it even appears in Tshuvot or not, I don't know. But it's a good indication of the type of mindset of a certain sector of our society which refuses to see the fact that the halakha has changed in the past and must change in order to accommodate new situations. Now, as Dr. Shapiro mentioned yesterday in passing when he discussed Rav Kook Zitzal, Rav Kook came up with a statement which is in direct opposition to the slogan of the Chatam Sofer. The Chatam Sofer said, Chadash Asur Min HaTorah, innovation is forbidden by biblical law. And Rav Kook said, "Hachadash hayashan yitchadesh, v'hachadash yitkadesh. That which is old will be renewed, and that which is innovative will be sanctified. Hayashan yitchadesh, v'hachadash yitkadesh." There couldn't be two slogans that were more diametrically opposed than that of the Chatam Sofer and that of Rav Kook Zitzal. Now, I don't really think that when the Chatam Sofer made this statement and used this argument in his polemics against the emerging reform movement, I don't think he had ever any sort of intention that it should take on this life of its own, so much so that you couldn't pair the table, the three-legged table, to burn the end of your nail pairings. But it is in the nature of these types of halakhic developments that at the time they take upon themselves an independent life and move off in directions which at times can be completely absurd. And the truth is that this has continued into the present day, and I've collected in one of my books examples from the weekly parsha sheets that we find in the synagogues nowadays in Jerusalem, of statements which are completely unbelievable. And again, let me give you an example which I found recently in a very important halakhic journal called Or Torah, which is published in Monsey, and it's excellent, and it's edited by real first-class Talmidei Chachamim, who also happen to be Sotmar Hasidim. And I found the following little article. The article was headed Chadash Asur Min HaTorah. The story was as follows. In Monsey, they published a new edition of the Tanakh for use in the synagogues and houses, printed nicely. And they wrote in the introduction to this Tanakh that the Tanakh, no, sorry, it wasn't a Tanakh, it was Tehillim book. And they wrote in the introduction that the text is very accurate because it's based on Keter Aram Tzoba, on the Keter Chaleb, which was the manuscript which was used, it appears, by the Rambam in his Hilchot Sefer Torah to determine the exact text, punctuation, etc., and of the Sefer Torah. So it is basically the most canonic and accurate manuscript that we have. It's attributed to Ben Asher, the great Masoret, and we know that the Rambam followed his opinions. And this manuscript, which exists in Jerusalem, it's partially defective. Much of the Chumash, up to the middle of Dvarim, has been now lost, although certain fragments exist, but the rest of it exists. And it was sort of secretly smuggled out of Aleppo, perhaps 20 years ago, now to the sites in Jerusalem. And it is the most accurate version of the Torah. So they wrote in the introduction that we have printed an edition of Tehillim with the correct punctuation, with the correct vocalization, and with the correct spelling. And this is a very accurate form. To which there was a response in this Or Torah, this journal, that said, how do these people have the chutzpah to abandon our accepted version of Tehillim and give us this Nusach Chadash Shasur Min HaTorah? So the Rambam's version, based on the most accurate version that we have of Tehillim, is something which is forbidden because it's an innovation. Well, if that's an innovation, then almost anything is an innovation. And then anything is Asur Min HaTorah. So we see that in certain sectors of our society and of our rabbinic establishment, there has been something of a stultification of halakha, a petrification of halakha. Now, there are various reasons for this. Not merely the fact that people were following the Chatam Sofer, that they felt that they had to create a bulwark against the other streams of Judaism, conservatism, reform in England, the liberal movement, in Hungary, the Neolog movement, There were additional reasons too. One of the reasons was that halakhas become very complex. It's like a family tree. You start off with one opinion and it splits into two, and then each two of them is discussed by two different authorities who have differences of opinion, so there are four, and so it goes on. And anybody who looks into any halakhic volume, the Shulchan Aruch, will see that there's a central area printed in big letters, and then there are opinions on either side in smaller letters, and then in even smaller letters in Rashi script there are additional things, and it goes on and on and on, so that for any particular halakhic issue there are a dozen different ways of approaching them. Now, how do you make sure that you don't go wrong? You choose the strictest. You choose that which in a sense will encompass all the other ones. You always take the Chumrah because that way you're playing safe. Even though, if you read Sifrei Halakha, classical halakhic books, they will tell you that the Chumrah is not a Hora'ah. It's not a halakhic determination. It's an escape from halakhic determination. It's a way of avoiding thinking things out and coming to a clear conclusion. So this is another reason. Firstly, there's the petrification. Secondly, there's the fear of making a mistake, which yirat ha-hora'ah, which means always take the most stringent point of view. And then there's another element to take into account. At one time, rabbis lived in small communities, and they had the authority to rule for their communities, and everybody was beholden to them. And what they said went, and it didn't go outside the community. There wasn't mass communications. Nobody knew what went on from one village to the next. Nowadays, there's no such thing as private psak. Everything has become publicized, whether it's the internet, the radio. I'll tell you a personal story. There was, some years ago, they were building a major road in Jerusalem, and they came across some graves. Ancient graves. Now, in Israel there's an organization, a Haredi organization called Atzer Kadisha, and as soon as they say bones, you're not allowed to do anything. You mustn't continue over there. Even though the bones were probably animal bones, and there's no way of knowing if they're Jewish or non-Jewish bones, nonetheless, they said you can't continue, and they made, you know, they burnt the dustbins and whatever they do in that sort of part of the world, put up posters, threatened everybody. At the time, the chief rabbi of Jerusalem, the Ashkenazi chief rabbi, was Rav Kolitz Zichrono Divracha, a great Talmid Chacham and a saintly person whom we were very close to, our family was very close to. So I went to him and I said to him, look, we realize there's a situation, but there is a passage in Masechet Eivel Rabati, Masechet Smachot, which is that Masechet that deals with burial and graves, etc., that says that if there was a grave which was originally outside the city, and the city grew and encompassed that grave in such a way that it constituted a difficulty, because Kohanim couldn't go there, people would become tamei, it is permissible to move that to another location. Now, there was some difficulty as to the text of that particular passage in Masechet Sofri, in Masechet Smachot, but that's the reason, the reading of the Gra, of the Gaon of Vilna. I said, let us follow the reading of the Gaon of Vilna, and let us move this grave to another place, otherwise they would have to spend 90 million shekels to reroute the road. 90 million. How many Haredi Koilanim could you support with that? So he said, the Seder, I'll look into it. And this was a private conversation between two of us in his salon. The next day, in Haaretz, there was a notice that Professor Sperber has suggested something absolutely unacceptable, moving bones of ancient Jews. We didn't even know, they hadn't even examined to know whether they were people or whether they were animals as yet. So, and of course there was a repercussion of it, and then everybody started writing for and against, and it became a cause célèbre. In the end they had to move the road and spend this huge amount of money in order to reroute the road, northern Jerusalem. So when you have a situation where whatever you say is no longer private but becomes publicized, then most people are afraid of the results, and they're not willing to give their own personal opinions, and they obviously are just going to choose the easiest way out, which is the way out, which is the Chumrah. Chumrah is the easiest way out. You're not going to be criticized by your colleagues for your Chumrah. So, for various reasons, historical, sociological, and even the threat of the modernity of mass communications have brought about a whole change in our halachic culture. Now, I see this as something which is anti-halachic. I see that Chadash Asur Min HaTorah was the greatest innovation that was possible because it was completely against halacha. That in itself was a chidush which he should have realized. There was an internal contradiction, since in all times prior to that, halachists had always been innovating and changing and modifying and modulating in order to stand up, to face up to the challenges that faced them in their particular time and age. And therefore I think it's very important for us, as modern Orthodox people, to be aware of what's happened and to realize that we have to try to make a change. And the change is to revert to the classical halachic mode of thinking, lachzir atara leyoshna, which is to face up honestly to the challenges that modern society has put before us and to seek solutions. One example of this, and I'm not sure whether Doctors Mark Shapiro and Kellner are going to be put in Cherem, or possibly they'll never get to Gan Eden, or because they're heretics for their terrible heretic views on philosophical manners. I will probably go and sit next to them for my halakhic determinations, which are probably equally unacceptable, and I feel that I'm going to be in very good company. At least it'll be interesting, it'll be fun. I always thought that the idea of tzaddikim sheyoshvim v'atarateyam v'ne'ni mizivas shekhina sounds very boring indeed. But depends, I guess, how hot purgatory is, really. We don't really know about these things. Nobody really come back to tell us. But I've taken a position on women's issues, and I've always stressed that I'm not a feminist. I see myself as a halachist. I see things which present-day society is challenging us with. The whole status of women nowadays is totally different to that which it was 100 years ago, 150, and certainly 500 years ago. And since the status of women has changed, and since we have women prime ministers, we have women Supreme Court judges, we have women ombudsmen, we have women CEOs, I don't find at all the fact embarrassing that I might be judged by a woman judge in a court case. And therefore I don't see any sort of embarrassment. There isn't any question of Kvod HaTzibur if a woman would read in the Torah in the synagogue. I don't think there's any sort of problem halachically. I think it's absolutely perfectly permitted, and I try to argue it halachically, but that's already a whole new subject, and a subject which requires careful halachic discussion, and it's a discussion that's built on many tiers. But I do think that what is even more important is that those women who feel that they are being unjustly regarded, treated, and they feel offended by the fact that they're not accorded certain types of privileges which are permitted to them, that is an absolute isur, because there's a principle of Kvod HaBriyot, that you have to take into account people's sensitivity. sensitivity of people, individuals, and sensitivity of societies in general. Now this is a whole large subject which I won't go into now, but I think that when we talk of the challenges of society, we're talking of challenges which are in all sorts of natures. They're societal changes, they're economic changes, and they have to express themselves, they have to come to some sort of expression in the halakha. That is not to say that every single problem that the halakha poses before us, we will be able to find a solution for all people, for all such cases. In any legal system, there are always certain people who unfortunately will suffer. But they will be a small minority, and the vast majority will have solutions which are acceptable to them, and which are legitimate halakhically, and which will make their life much more livable. And this is what we have to aim at. We have to look at the sources, we have to take into account what contemporary situations pose before us, we have to take into account the changes in modern science. I didn't go into that as this talk today, but I really think that lice, that you're not allowed to kill a louse on Shabbat. That's metilat nefesh in my opinion. And so I think that it takes a certain amount of courage to go against the mainstream. Unfortunately, the mainstream at the moment is dominated by the Haredi community, who have great gedolim, but nonetheless, as I mentioned yesterday, they often give halakhic opinions which they present as determinations in areas which they have really no understanding of, or very little understanding of. And therefore, those people who have the courage to stand as individuals should examine these new challenges, seek out acceptable solutions to them, and the truth is that they will be battered in the as a result of that, and they may be banned. But to end, I'd like to quote a tshuva of the Chatam Sofer himself, since we began with him. The Tzvi Eshchayas, who was a great contemporary of his, wrote a book which described his understanding of the development of halakha. And before it was published, he wrote a letter to the Chatam Sofer, and he said, I've written this book, and it is provocative, and it has new ideas, and I'm sure that I will suffer as a result of this. Should I publish it or not? The Chatam Sofer answers him as follows. He says that in the Gemara in Masechet Beitza, there's a story told of Rabbi Abba, who came to Eretz Yisrael from Babel, and he made before he went into the yeshiva of Rabbi Yochanan, he made a prayer, may it be thy will, O God, that my views be accepted by my colleagues in Eretz Yisrael. And when he went into the yeshiva and they started discussing, he gave a svara, he gave some sort of an interpretation, and they mocked him and belittled him. Rabbi Nechunya ben Kaneh in Masechet Brachot had also a little prayer that he made before he entered into the yeshiva every morning. May be thy will that I not err in bedvar halacha, in my halachic determinations. Shelo yare takala bedvarai. And his prayer was completely accepted, and it's used up to the present day. So the Chatam Sofer said, what was the difference between these two requests from God? Why was Rabbi Abbas not accepted, and he was belittled and mocked, and Rabbi Nechunya ben Atkanez accepted? He said, because when you give a halachic determination, you shouldn't be concerned with what your neighbors will say. You shouldn't say that I should find favor in my colleagues. You should say what you think and what you believe to be the truth. And therefore, he said, you should publish your book and not worry about other people. And he said, that is what I do. And this is, in a sense, already mentioned in the Talmud, when the Talmud says that the Dayan, when he gives a determination, a halachic psak, who tzarich latet din emet le'amito. Not din emet, but din emet le'amito, a true ruling according to his understanding of truth, his personal understanding of truth. Not what other people will think. Not what the rabbi next door will say. So, having started with the Chatam Sofer, I end with the Chatam Sofer, and as I say, I think people have to have courage to face up to the challenges which are presented by modern society, which are made very difficult, and I'm keenly aware of the fact that there exists this threat of the slippery slope, and we haven't here discussed the boundaries of change. All these things are difficult to do in 45 minutes.